Priya and this story, and I have repeatedly started to put those two together here. And I thought just now that maybe Priya Vrata can be Pio's channel on YouTube, because it's really what it is. But anyway, we are talking Dharma here, and I'm looking now Game Theory 22, where he is describing the French Revolution, I think, with Rousseau, with his theories. And I'm right now sitting here. I should have that somewhere pasted into my script document here, that there is this social contract theory, that, you know, there's a social contract between, agreed by all the citizens for their mutual preservation, that this is more important than just following some king or queen, that this was the basic of the French Revolution, and that this also, then there's something called the categorical imperative, and he brings up Jung here, that there is the general will, which is kind of above that. Not that it's just a sum total of all of our desires that makes truth, but there is a supreme moral principle that commands actions based on duty rather than personal desire or consequence. It's an absolute, unconditional requirement that must be obeyed in all circumstances. And the most famous formulation is the formula of universal law, which states that you should act only according to rules that you would be willing to see become universal laws for everyone. Those kind of thinking. So, not just democracy in the sense of popular vote, majority wins, which also, of course, works against freedom, the principle of freedom, which also democracy is priding itself of, isn't it? So, yeah, we can't get away from that. This, that there must be a higher general absolute truth, so to speak. And this is really also what Dharma is about, finding that absolute truth behind nature, that everything works according to, not just some, you know, theoretical, philosophical idea that someone comes up with and then brands as absolute truth, but rather a reality existing there. And of course, then one can ask, what is that reality? Where does that reality come from? Who decides ultimately? And there we have God. God is God, Mother Nature. That's the way she is. And we may argue about that and say, no, we are the lords of nature. You follow our directives. We are supreme. We are the crown jewels of evolution, we humans. But, you know, we can say that, but Mother Nature, you know, blossoms there in spring, gives us food and growth that we can, food that we can grow and enjoy, and so on. And we just need to follow her. Respect her, really. do a little work, and receive the gifts. It's not that we are slaves of Mother Nature. It's a mother. So that kind of view, not well, then we have the father as well. Or, you know, we have the whole thing running in the first place. You know, and that's how deeply you find this there in the Indian Vedic, you know, this ancient philosophy or understanding of the world, which even says itself is more than just philosophy, which is called jnana, and that's kind of part, some step on the way, but it continues to how we live and how we experience the moment and our lives and the world. So it kind of ties well into this, because we can find it all over the world, that when humans start thinking really deeply, someone sits down and deeply contemplates what's going on here, you kind of go, if you're not motivated by greed or hate or whatever it is, some kind of psychopath, narcissist, me first desire, which then controls your way of thinking. Therefore, these philosophers and so on, they're traditionally, historically, they are the wise people who can think dispassionately. And they come to the same, start to say, see the same conclusion, just like we find here with Kant. It's basically also the way I see it, speaking about Dharma as well. And we get it from China, we get it from all over in these old cultures, that we should just follow the ways of nature, which Dharma means. The ways of mother and father, Mother Nature, Father Heaven, and so on. So, talking Kant here, the first then is universality. And it's kind of a thought experiment. We can make it here, we can show it also in our story, as image or even animation. That just imagine that what you do now, everyone in the entire universe does too. So if you smile now, everyone smiles around you. And if you're angry, everyone is angry around you. So I guess we would like to live in a society where everyone is smiling rather than that everyone is angry, right? And therefore, that's the law of universality. And then there is free will, number two here. No one can force you to smile. You must smile out of your own free choice. So yeah, that's free will. No one can force you to love. You do that by your own free choice. Not even God mingles with that. Because then it wouldn't be fun anymore, right? Then we would just be puppets. But we are possessing the same integrity as God, in the sense of having free will to create our lives, and an immense ability to do so through our imaginative power. But anyway, That's point two here in Kant. So I can, you know, someone can say, you know, but you're not smiling. That's against universality. So you should smile. When you do, you become happy. And we all become happy. And if you don't smile, then you're making us unhappy. So we also don't smile. But you can't force that. Forced smiles are, first of all, visible from far away. And they are just that, false. Not universality, absolute truth anymore. So I can never sacrifice a human being in order to achieve a better society.
Because we are the ultimate end.
Because we are the ultimate end of that society. The society is there to serve us. So these together, the categorical imperative, is what gives us the theory of the general will. Again, we are back there at the French Revolution and, you know, the ideas, they're coming from Rousseau and Kant and others. So in other words, we might all just want to eat ice cream all day. But that's not what's good. That's not the categorical imperative. In other words, that's not what makes us happy. It's not what makes it work for us in nature. I mean, so there are ways to live, things to eat, and so on, things to do, ways to think. That simply are for real and are true and corresponds to reality and nature. And we might agree with, admit, acknowledge that, or disagree, rebel against it and want to do it our own way. You know, I don't care. I'm going to eat ice cream only every day for the rest of my life, because I love ice cream. But then we, I guess, hopefully all know what the result be. You won't be happy. I want to have money, just more and more and more and more money. Unlimited of money. But again, that's not what will make you happy, and it may probably make others miserable too, because you will be such a greedy bastard. And you see, some of those people are gobbling up the entire planet, or trying to. So, but that won't work. It's against nature. It's not making you happy and not others. So really, when we look at Dharma, we can see it that way. That when you live, you know, we have this word, Sanatana Dharma, that's the eternal, that's the ultimate reality, really, for us. And all philosophy and all religion, all the evolutions of human consciousness, which I would say is the real evolution that should go on, is there to bring about that Sanatana Dharma, meaning that we find ourselves the way we really are. We find this nature, this world, the way it really is and the way it really works. Rather, she and him and all of us. Because, you know, it's a big, beautiful community of life. Even the bird that lands on my tree outside my window. You know, we're all part of the bigger family here. So that's what it's about. And it's really about reconnecting with God again. God is in God. And reconnecting, meaning then that we see that we are not bundles of matter. We are rays of God. God is in God. And with that simple change of consciousness or arisal of consciousness, we are in reality. We are seeing things the way things are, the way we are. And we are reconnected to our source. And all light and life and knowledge and joy will flow through us. Because that's really our dharma, you could say, our constitutional actual existence, natural existence, to be happy. Happy adventure, that's what life and the cosmos is about. So anyway, back to statesmanship, French Revolution, all that. And we're really talking about the development of the nation state. I think that's how he puts it. Yeah. So you have then the general will based on this categorical imperative. And that general will is sovereign. Meaning it just it stands there ruling over everything. And everyone, because it's, you know, in its ideal, mature form, it's Dharma. So the idea then is that this sovereignty should be the state. The state should be achieved from this general will, from the sovereign. And the state then makes us into citizens. And we have laws, culture, education. So this is the social contract that they thought of, and the basis of the nation state rather than the monarchy and all that, right? Which sounds good, doesn't it? Well, the way I immediately see it is that, yeah, but the sovereign, the absolute truth up there, the absolute reality there, who decides what it is, and who is the state? There's a government, right? Whose duty it then is to maintain the awareness and knowledge of and the harmony with that general will, that again, we can use the word that Dharma, the way things are. And thus, the way that our society should work in order for everyone to be happy. It makes perfect sense, right? But again, to respect the free will of the individuals. Well, I can see it. You have a society here that is built on dharma, and you have a government that rules, in other words, manages, serves the people, and I shouldn't even use the word rule, maybe. But you could say implements, yes, those rules that dharma dictates. In other words, here we have a knowledge about how nature works. We shouldn't destroy the water, we shouldn't destroy the air, and so on. And our government is here implementing that through strength, through power of action, because government means that there are people there who have that strength of implementing, doing, making things happen. And again, in lower, more primitive, barbarian societies, that strength is more about you do as I say. Otherwise, I'll beat you up. Because I have the absolute truth here, you know. And look, I have an army and police. You can't do anything, you know, just surrender. But rather, here we have this society works like this. If you come to this country, these are the laws we have here based on this. You're welcome to live it, but then you follow those laws. Otherwise, you go to another place. In other words, you have free will, and you can make your own if you want. And in the old days, there weren't these big multi-million cities. In the old Indian teachings, it said you should have maximum 50,000 people in a town. And I think that if you look at the old India, there are certainly those who know better than I. But a little bit I tried to figure out from the Mahabharata, for instance, the size of the Yadu kingdom there. It probably was like that it had a radius of maybe or diameter of 300 kilometers or something. Which is about the width of Sweden, or you could say rather a county in Sweden. And I think if we look at these counties and provinces and all that we find in every country, I guess, more or less at least, they probably are often that size. And I think they are probably also, correct me if I'm wrong, developed from that communal origins of a group of people. You know, I belong to the West Goths, for instance, which is like a bit south from here, but not all the way south, at the southern edge of the lakes. That's where I'm from. We are West Goths, and I think you can trace back that history. I'm just speculating now, but to more like families, dynasties, families that became bigger and they joined together, and that's what communalism is. So I would say that this could naturally grow to that size of, you know, you might have a capital there of 50,000 people or something. That's the big city. You know, my town that I was born in and grew up in was 10,000 people, nine. And mainly there were such towns all over the place, and even smaller ones, villages. So 50,000, and you were in the city. And generally you had such a city as the kind of quote-unquote capital of that county. And where you, I mean, it seems like in the old days you had a kind of a king or lord of some kind there, and a castle. And yeah, I mean, then you had feudalism, where that power person ruled. But it could also, and I would say that this is, could have been that communalism before the feudalism came, which is again kind of early capitalism stage. You know, me want more power, more money. I'm big. Big palace, big building, look at me, invite me to your parties, because I'm someone. You know, that kind of psychopath, as you call it today, narcissist nature, or someone who is an heroic, power-strong person, but, and who, yeah, sure, likes to bask in that glory, but who fulfills the responsibility, protects the people, has the intelligence, you know, and the advisors, and to really make up the right plans and the solutions, and then has the strength to see them being carried out. So, again, it's about people. And what's going on there in the heart and mind of people, especially those who are sitting there in power positions. But I'm saying this because that seems to me to be, again, a dharmic, balanced form of society like that, where there is a kind of local self-sufficiency, like a small country the size of a county, which means there could be like 20 of them in what we call the Sweden. That mainly take care of themselves. And I mean, when I grew up, it was much like that in our town. The areas around there, where you have the farmers and you have all different kinds of production and people needed by the people living there. So in this way, we find it can work and has worked and still is working in many places very nicely. And I would say more on that local level. But again, the problems appear when the non-dharmic thinking creeps in, where the vices are ruling instead of the virtues. Lust, greed, envy, illusions, fear, and so on, all of those hang together. And when the leaders and the citizens which, you know, very much follow the leaders who are in charge also of the media and education and all of that, when they also start picking up that mentality. And then you will find yourself living in a basically lawless state where everyone is just in it for themselves. And that is the norm. And even we find today, and have found so for hundreds of years, from this materialism that has been ruling, it's a philosophy that has been ruling our societies, especially here in Europe and the West, for more than 100 years now, which even dictates, postulates, that selfishness and greed and all that is the law of nature, is what it's all about. Survival of the fittest. Law of the jungle. The big lion rules because it's stronger, has sharper teeth. So, again, when we speak about Dharma now, we speak about, again, looking at history, looking at the accumulated, gathered knowledge throughout history, and wisening up a bit, because it's not really rocket science we were talking about here. Even I can talk about it here, and I'm not a philosopher, big thinker, or academic or intellectual. I'm just an ordinary guy. But even we ordinary girls and guys are able to understand these things and should wake up to these things, because in this way we can actually be happy by living dharmic lives, individually and socially. So it's all about us becoming happy and satisfied, which again I hope we can see is a categorical imperative of the general will that we should all accept as sovereign absolute truth. So, do that which you want to see everyone around you do. Smile, or whatever you want to, but then be prepared for others around you being a bit the same. Birds of the same feather flock together, you know.